Kilometers from Takaka in the Golden Bay region. Very awesome place, but I'd like to actually give myself a formal introduction. It's a takeoff based on a really cool TV show from the 1960s that I've been watching lately. It's called Danger Man, produced by a guy named Ralph Smart, who went on to produce the legendary Man from U.N.C.L.E. series that I watched last year with Napoleon Solo and the ever-popular Ilya Kuryakin. Danger Man begins like this. Every country has its own secret service. USA, CIA, England, MI5, France, Jersey and Bureau. NATO has its own secret agents. And whenever they have a messy job that needs to be done, they call on me or someone like me. My name's Weverson. Jeff Weverson. Actually, the character's name was Drake. John Drake. But he's a badass. And it's a really, really cool show. It's only 30 minutes, but it's quite to the point, and he's very good and efficient at what he does. And he actually thrives on being in extreme danger. And he always miraculously works it out. And there's always beautiful women involved, but unlike Napoleon Solo, he's not blatantly hooking up with them, not in any of the episodes I've seen so far. I'm about two-thirds of the way through the first season. Anyway, this show is about a beautiful situation that I find myself in here. I didn't really see it coming, but after being here for two or three days, I really started to realize that the beautiful place where I am is actually a true low-noise reserve. Now, anybody who knows me fully understands exactly what I'm talking about. And I won't tell you too much about Rainbow Valley, but there's beautiful people here. It's got an interesting history dating back to the early 1970s. In fact, two of the American couples that were original founders are actually visiting here right now, who I've met briefly. All the people are really low-key, down-to-earth people. There's no hoo-ha or hootha that I've detected. That's an acronym for heads up his ass or heads up their ass, which I actually have used that expression before, but I heard it actually made into an acronym by a radio DJ in Adelaide, South Australia, probably about 15 years ago. Hoo-ha. This is a very healing place. I'm about 200 meters from the Anantaki River. I can actually hear it right now. It's a good bit of rustling of the leaves and the trees and cicadas and birds singing. But you hear the sound of the river all through the day and night, similar to how I'm more used to hearing the sound of the ocean, often being in proximity to her. But there's a beautiful and pervasive tranquility here, which really seems like it's like as it should be. But what really struck me just really yesterday, I started realizing that what I'm actually experiencing is the relative absence of anthropogenic noise of any kind. And this is a community with all about 25 people live here permanently, and within half a kilometer of me right now is about a dozen houses. And most of them are about 300 meters away. There's nobody right on top of me, like in a city or anything like that. But I just really started noticing how quiet it actually is. And by quiet, I don't mean total silence, as in the complete absence of sound. The microphone on my video camera may be, I'm sure it's picking up the cicadas, and you might get a bit of the rustling of the wind. And the cicadas can be quite loud when you go into the woods, so nature's not always quiet. But the absence of anthropogenic noise is striking. And it really made me realize just how much noise that I am constantly around and what a great negative effect it has on me. And I think that it really has a destructive effect on everyone to varying degrees. But, for example, if you drink some poison, it can make you sick or kill you, even if you never tasted it. Same thing with noise. Just because you don't consciously hear it doesn't mean it's not having an adverse physiological and or psychological effect on you. Now, this show is about issues relating to bioacoustics and noise and hearing and sound and the voice of nature that I've talked about on several shows before, and I'm not trying to cover everything in this one broadcast because it's a huge topic and could devote several shows to it. In fact, a show I'm probably going to be recording this coming week with musician Peter Phippen in Wisconsin. We're going to talk a lot about not just music, and we'll probably begin with one of my favorite quotes from Steve Martin, the comedian and musician, who said, "Talking about music is like dancing about architecture. It's totally different forms of expression or sharing or communication that don't necessarily or even at all translate into or capable of being expressed by the other. So talking about music is nothing like playing music or listening to music. And I'm actually generating sound with my voice. And that alone is a huge area of research and investigation and awareness. The way that we use the spoken word and the history of language, won't really touch on that in this show. But here, other than the noise of the insects and the birds and the wind, pretty much the only thing I've heard in about 5 days, I've heard 3 or 4 tractors, but in the distance. I've heard 6 or 8 cars come and go, but in the distance, and they're not going fast. They're not kicking up a cloud of dust either. I've heard maybe 6 planes in 5 or 6 days. No helicopters. And it's been many years since I've actually been in an environment like this, in a place where I was actually staying in an accommodation of some kind. The times that I've camped out, like when Lisbon and I would camp out in remote places like with Grandmother Pahutakala on Great Barrier Island, or in Fjordland, or the months that we spent living at Arne Erickson's remote property on Flinders Island, Tasmania. These are times when we've had similar lack of anthropogenic noise. But in recent years, even ironically on Great Barrier Island, which is my most special home away from home, or it's my home at home, in the past few years there, both the density of the people, both that are spending more and more time there year-round, and the density of construction, houses going up in lots in between houses where there should really be nothing, approaching actually literally the density of a city. They're allowing that to happen. And it used to be when I first went there in 2006 that it was a very quiet place. There would be like almost whole days when I wouldn't hear any noise of people at all. Maybe the occasional car, maybe the occasional motorcycle, very rarely a lawnmower or something like that. This was in 2006. And this was in the spring when I was there in October. But in recent years, a combination of circumstances has made it Great Barrier Island, or Aotea, the subject of my most intensive bioacoustic awareness work. Because I like to spend most of my time outside if possible, especially if I'm painting, because for the natural light, I like to hear the sounds of nature, the birds and the bees and the wind. And there's just something really spiritually and psychologically profound or important to me about not being enclosed in walls and a roof. And even if I am, to have as much doors and windows open as possible, there's just a connection that I feel. And it's partly, probably very subtle acoustic vibrations that you hear, the sound pressure waves coming from the distant parts of the atmosphere and beyond, outside the solar system. I think that we're all very, very attuned to this, and it's not just optical. It's not just electromagnetic. I think it's also acoustic, but this is so subtle. We're talking about levels of perception that the modern-day human has no recollection of ever being conscious of it, yet I think it's there. And I think that the whales and dolphins, for example, this is one of the few shows in which they don't feature as the main topic of conversation. But I really feel that they're not only the masters of sound, but that they are able to tune into vibrations in the body of Mother Ocean that provide them with a full spectrum of information about processes and events and goings on in the heliocosm of the solar system and things happening in there that could be of consequence to life on Earth. On Great Barrier Island, on a typical day, I might hear several dozen planes. These are single and twin engine planes operated by the two airlines there primarily. And I just had an interesting conversation with a bus driver named Charles Kuipers a few weeks ago, who's actually a scuba diver and a pilot himself. He told me a lot about these planes and that they're notorious, especially the ones used by one of the airlines. The planes they use are notorious for being loud, as if they were chainsaws in the sky, which is exactly what they sound like. And so there's a constant buzzing of those in the sky there on Great Barrier, and on holiday times, on the Saturday afternoon of a public holiday weekend a few years ago, I logged over 50 plane flights over Netherlands Beach between noon and 5 p.m. that day. 50. That's 50. So that's each one I heard for probably 2 to 5 minutes. So 50 times 3. Let's say each one was 3 minutes. That's almost 3 hours of significant anthropogenic noise just from planes alone. And then often you've got multiple noise sources happening at the same time. You might have somebody that comes along and mows their lawn, and a plane comes, and then a car goes by. Somebody's using their whippersnipper, and a motorcycle might come. Then people come with the council on mega mowers that sounds like a helicopter. They come along, and then the mulchers with people that can't just chop up their logs and their leaves and compost, that they've got to mulch it down into dust. And those are like screeching military level tree munching devices. So all this stuff on Great Barrier, because I spend a lot of time there, I'm blessedly lucky to be able to, but my time there is largely, almost exclusively outside, almost exclusively without music or radio or anything playing. And my hearing is very acute. And I also pay attention. So it's like, I don't want to tune out sound. Some people go like, oh, just don't pay any attention to it. I go like, look, I don't work like that. My senses are designed, as are, I think, everyone's really, for tuning into and helping us be aware of the different qualities of our surroundings. It tunes us in with our family and helps us communicate and to hear their voice. So to have all this blocked out or interfered with or disrupted is very destructive psychologically and spiritually. Not to mention the physiologically destructive aspects of mechanical noise just from the sheer waveform and the frequency and the repetition and the intensity of the sound. All these combine to make anthropogenic noise very lethal. And even more so to beings in the ocean, in which sound travels much faster and more intensely than in air. Lest I forget to mention, I've also not heard any dogs barking out here at Rainbow Valley, which is another really big issue on Great Barrier Reef, even with all the work underway to keep people's dogs off the beach and stuff like that. It's like everybody who comes there and almost everybody who lives there has at least one dog. And so here, I think people might have dogs, but maybe they just don't. But I haven't heard any dogs barking here, which is quite remarkable. And I don't think that Rainbow Valley set out consciously to make themselves into a low noise reserve. It's just kind of like a side effect or a byproduct that's kind of accidentally happened. But it's really something to be, have awareness drawn to and to be honored and cherished and nurtured and protected. I find that when I'm sitting here, like I'm sitting at my desk right now. The last show was recorded sitting by the Anantucky River, which was generating a good bit of kind of white noise in the background, and the cicadas. I'm sure you can hear the cicadas now, but this is the ambient noise level at which I've been sitting here painting for the past few days, and it's just so, it's having such a beautiful effect on me. I'm actually able to find that I can sit and think and concentrate for long expanses of time without having my train of thought distracted or disrupted by a noise. And I've got so used to that almost everywhere I've been in recent years that it almost seems like that I forgot what I was missing. But here I'm able to actually, I can tell the more days and the more time I spend here, the more my whole creative process will kind of return to what it should really be, because we're creatures of habit. We habituate or get used to all different kinds of situations and stimuli. People get used to shitty relationships. They get used to negative housing situations. They get used to smells. They get used to being bombarded by microwaves. They get used to noise. Like if you hear a chronic noise, like a water pump or something like that, that is in your environment day in and day out, chances are at some point you're probably going to be tuning it out. And it doesn't mean you're not hearing it. It just means that you're not paying attention to it. So like I said, it's still probably using up some of your cognitive energy to do that blocking. And at some level, you're still aware of it. You know, the vibration that, which is what the sound actually is still there. It's still impinging on your eardrum and your nervous system and your body. So all these vibrations affect us. Even if you're deaf, even if you're completely deaf and can't hear, you can still be affected negatively by noise because of the sheer disharmonious vibrations that it creates. Sound is incredibly important, I would say, probably to all life forms at some level, because sound is, it's a form of mechanical vibration. It's not electromagnetic. So this is a web of connection that ties everything together on the whole planet. I always tell people that. They'll go like, once a policeman came to visit me on Great Barrier Island, and the first thing he said like was, Jeff, so you're the guy who doesn't like noise. Because I'd had a little issue with one of the neighbors about running a generator. And I go like, well, so what, let me guess, you like noise, right? Is that it? And no, I don't like noise. It's a fact of life, especially in urban environments. And I've made my share of noise. I've used chainsaws a lot. I've mowed yards. I've drive cars. I've used power tools, but I don't do it very much. And I don't like to make noise. I don't like to be observed or have my presence felt by other people, so you're rarely going to see me talking on phone and in public. Like, I don't want someone listening to me. I don't want them to have to listen to me. Like right now, I'm in an environment where no one can hear me right now except for me. I'm very sensitive about noise and sound, and partly because I've been exposed to other people's noise and sound so mindlessly and thoughtlessly so many times over the years. People just break out their phone and start having a really loud conversation, especially les Français, who tend to have the loudest voices around these days. I don't know why. But other life forms are affected by the sounds that we make. Like when we have created an environment with chronic noise, like planes and traffic, birds that live near highways and airports and stuff, scientists have actually noticed that they use the word shouting. They have to raise their voice, and dolphins do it too. They have to raise their voice to try to be heard by their mates and their friends and their family. So this is one of many effects that our noise has that we tend to not even have on our radar. Just because we may not observe an overt behavioral change in an animal or a fellow being's behavior, does not mean that they're not aware of it, that they're not being affected. If someone was looking at us from a distance, if we were profoundly annoyed or even angry with a noise, no one could tell just by looking at us what we thought or felt. You know, so that's kind of our whole attitude towards all our fellow non-human beings, that we think that they don't even have feelings, or they aren't aware of stuff, or that they aren't capable of experiencing being annoyed, which is totally wrong. Now there's this trendy, popular thing going around now called the Dark Sky Reserve, and I don't know who thought this up. It's been around for a few years. I sort of looked into it once, and it just sounds like a bunch of bureaucratic gobbledygook to me, but I've been exposed to it a lot because Great Barrier Island, Aotea, where I spend a lot of time, has been made into one as of a couple of years ago. They got the full Monty Dark Sky rating, and to me, it's just kind of absurd, because why do you need that? And so ultimately, all it is a tourism gimmick to try to attract people to come there and spend a bunch of money for accommodation and renting vehicles and stuff, and therefore, by their very presence, creating more light pollution. So I don't know if the people have thought about that or not, but you don't really need for a place to be declared a dark sky reserve in order for anybody that actually cares. Like, for example, amateur astronomers, people that like to do astronomical photography, that kind of thing, they're going to know anyway. So all it is, it's a tourism gimmick designed to bring yet more people to places that really don't need more people. And a friend of mine here in Takaka said that he wanted to get behind trying to make Takaka into one of these dark sky reserves, and I believe the area down around Lake Tekapo, further south on the South Island, is one too. But it has nothing to do with how dark the sky really is, because there's many, many, many places that have equally dark skies. It's just places that are where there's trendy people that might have a dark enough sky to qualify, so that they can get this rating and probably attach the word eco. It's eco-optical or something like that, but it's all just, to me, I'll use the word, yes, bullshit. It's bullshit to me. But to me, you know, and these places aren't really that far as the crow flies, or as the photon flies, for example. For example, Great Barrier Island is less than 100 kilometers from Auckland, which is a huge light-emitting metropolitan area. So you can see the glow from Auckland every night from Great Barrier Island. So what does that tell you? Plus, you're at sea level, you're next to the ocean. The weather there is not that great a lot of the year. So that's why they put You're never going to find a major observatory there, or even any observatory. They put them in places like up in the mountains in the center of Australia, like Siding Spring Observatory, where I visited a couple of years ago to visit some comet researchers. But there, they were fighting a battle to stop a giant gas plant fracking facility being put in sort of in the vicinity of the observatories, which was going to put out a lot of light at night. And I think that this got shot down. And even on top of Mauna Kea, the highest peak in the Pacific Ocean where I was back in April, even from up there at night, you can see the lights down around the horizon from Hilo and from Kona. So really, the only places to totally get away from anthropogenic light would be in really remote places, like in the Himalayas, Siberia. Probably it might be harder and harder anywhere in Australia because of the pervasiveness and ubiquity of the mining industry. Any mine site is going to be throwing out a lot of light at night. I've noticed the last time I went through Western Australia that places where in 2009 had been completely dark at night, the next year or two they had all kinds of arcs of light coming up around from where there was mining sites that had been built. So who knows what that would be like now. So what exactly would a low noise reserve be if we wanted to bureaucratize this and have people actually fulfill certain criteria? You know, it's something to think about because it would, I mean, if the biggest problem with it is getting this on people's radar, getting people to care, because even my friends that are all into the Dark Sky Initiative, they really don't have a problem with noise at all. They go like, oh, these planes, they're bringing all the tourists here that are bringing money to the island. And all the, oh, we've got to mow our lawns and people have to chop their wood and the hedges need to be cut and the bark has to be mulched and those motorcycles, well, they should be their right to go fast. I mean, you know, there's just a rationalization and an excuse for everything. But, so getting people to actually care about it, because, see, so many people, I'm a rarity because most people are going to be sitting around probably with the television on blaring, other people talking, the radio, they're on their phone, and a lot of people's hearing just isn't that good. And they don't mind, they're also indoors. So you add these three major factors in there, and that's why most people just don't really care about noise at all. They're just so used to hearing it. That's just reality. And in fact, you can go a step further and find that a lot of people are actually scared of silence or the lack of sound. Like if they don't hear somebody talking all the time, they start getting edgy. Or if they don't have some kind of form of entertainment with some kind of talking to give them a thread of connection to what they consider to be reality, they're obsessed with having some kind of noise going on, or even if it's just music. Like our friend Arnie on Flinders Island, he used to listen to the radio. He'd have it going all through the night, and we later learned that he might have been doing it just to annoy us. But he didn't mind sleeping with the radio on, and this is in an extremely remote place on Flinders Island, Tasmania. So you can chalk all this up to just one dimension of the sort of the dementality of the modern mind. But a low noise reserve could be places where people, for example, they strove to have no mow lawns, for example, using indigenous or imported little ground cover plants and gardens and stuff where you don't have to mow your lawn all the time. You could use electric powered tools for cutting your lawn and your hedge, or do it manually like we used to do. You could use rakes and brooms instead of blowers. If you need to mow your lawn, you could do it at certain times of day or only on certain days of the week, or people could agree that their people that live close together are only going to do their mowing or chainsawing at the same time, so that they're making their noise at the same time and won't bother each other. These are all things that could be accomplished if just some attention was put into it. Further than that, you could institute a policy like most places, if you want to burn rubbish, like definitely not on Rarotonga, because there everybody just burns stuff right next to their front door 24 hours a day, even if it's just dry as a tinderbox. Not counting Rarotonga, places like in New Zealand and Australia, you've got to get a permit to burn something to have a fire, even a campfire, because of the risk of bushfires. So if you had to get a permit to make noise, how cool would that be? It would create awareness about the fact that you're creating noise. So like if you needed to chainsaw a bunch of wood, you'd get a permit for that. If you needed to, mulch a bunch of bark, you'd get a permit for that. If you were gonna use your whippersnipper or your blower or anything like that, get a permit, and it won't be free. It doesn't have to be too expensive, but the main thing, it's not about the money, it's about the fact that you've got to be conscious of the fact that you're creating noise. And a lot of this, it actually boils down to whether people even are aware of or much less care about anybody other than themselves. So we're talking about a true form of selfishness here. If people actually thought that the sounds and noise they make, whether it's their voice talking, their lawnmower, their telephone ringing, their stereo, their car motor that they're hooning up, their airplanes, their helicopters, if they thought for a minute about who else can hear these sounds and whether they want to or not, but the fact that they actually don't have a choice. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't have the ability to just clog at my ears, and I'm not going to stuff earplugs in my ear. I've actually had people offer that as a solution. They're like, "But look, oh, Jeff, if you don't like the noise, why don't you just put in these earplugs?" I'm like, "Well, look, it doesn't quite work like that. You're the one making the noise, not me. So why should I be forced to listen to your noise?" Anyway, this is things I've been through a million times. There's a lot of room for improvement that we could all voluntarily lessen our bioacoustic impact and footprint, or earprint as it were. All this coming to say, it's made me so thankful to be able to experience the blessing of being here at the Rainbow Valley community, where it really is like, well, we are right on the very edge of the Kahurangi National Park, an area that has had 1080 dropped on it numerous times over the past few years. So that's something I'm learning a bit more about from the people here. But it's a very special area. And it's just really, really cool. Very healing for me to go through a whole day without being annoyed or having the... It's a negative feeling that's created in my body when I'm subjected to a loud, obnoxious noise. I was really overjoyed to learn of the work of a guy named Gordon Hempton. That's H-E-M-P-T-O-N. Not sure of his background, but he's got a little project, and it's a YouTube video that he's made called Sanctuaries of Silence. And he's based on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, which apparently is an extraordinarily quiet nature environment. But he goes there and records the sounds and the absence of anthropogenic noise. But he's got a movement and some projects going along honoring bioacoustic sensitivity and the importance of silence and the destructive aspects of noise. So he's very much on the same page as me, and I'm planning on getting in touch with him. So check out Sanctuaries of Silence on YouTube, and he's got a website called One Square Inch, which I'm not sure exactly how this is working, but it's about being bioacoustically responsible for the area where you inhabit, where you live. Also got in touch recently with a guy from Sydney named Mark Anderson, who has come up with the Nature Sound Map. Now, I haven't had because of my limited internet abilities in the past couple of weeks, haven't had a chance to check this out, but it's a map of the world with at least 60 or 80 different locations that you can click on it, and it'll take you to recordings of different sort of plants and animals and natural sounds and all these different areas. So this is a fantastic bioacoustic resource. And there's a third guy whose name I've known since the 1990s. There was a girl, a harp player from that played for soundtracks in Hollywood, whose name I forgot. But she repeatedly told me about a friend of hers who did, he worked in motion pictures doing sound effects and stuff like that, but he was also a recordist of natural sounds. His name is Bernie Krause, K-R-U-S-E. So just a couple of years ago, I started looking up his work, and it's called Bioacoustic Ecology, what his specialty is, and he's got a really cool TEDx talk that he gave. And I was thinking of trying to do an interview with him, but it seems like he's become kind of obsessed with the climate change thing, which might make it difficult for us to have an in-depth conversation. But his work is very important because his approach is that you can take a recording of, say, like a glade or a meadow or a valley. You can record and analyze the spectrum of sounds and the presence of all the different life forms, and then you can record that same area at a different time of year or in a different year and notice how things have changed, how a lot of sounds are gone, and things like that. And so you can sort of determine make an estimate of populations of different kind of life forms, insects and birds and things like that. And he's noticing that everything seems to be declining everywhere. So it's actually, it's an indicator of the robust vitality of an ecosystem, is the vibrancy and diversity of its soundscape. So this is something I'm really interested in. And I've interviewed my friend David Stewart on this show. He's a top Australian birdsong recordist based in the Brisbane area, and he's traveled all over the world. When I saw a map of all the places that he had recorded birdsongs, I just went like, I didn't know there was that many places on the earth, like thousands. But I hope to see him when I go back to Australia. But I'm interested in getting a really good microphone myself for recording interesting sounds. My little video camera does okay. There's another guy that I met in Santa Fe back in the 1980s, I think. His name was David Dunn, D-U-N-N. And he had gone out into the desert with hydrophones and recorded the sounds of microscopic insects that were living underwater in these pools of water on rocks before it evaporated in the desert of New Mexico. And I thought that was really, really cool, too. So, and in my work with the whales and dolphins, I've encountered a lot of really interesting acoustic phenomena. There's a guy named Alexander Lotterwasser, who lives in Germany, that creates visual images of sound called cymatics in the tradition of a European researcher named Hans Jenning. So this is really, really cool, the ability to visualize sound. And in my upcoming interview with Peter Phippen, we're probably going to talk about the esoteric dimensions of sound and music, about how all language was originally oral, long before we had writing, and how this ties in with animal communication and bird songs, and Stephen Mithen's interesting hypothesis in his book, the Oxford researcher that wrote The Singing Neanderthals, who hypothesizes that the Neanderthal beings, who in our modern mind, Neanderthal means like a barbarian savage or something like that, kind of like a Viking. They're like sitting in their cave gnawing on a bone and clubbing their partner. But in his view, the Neanderthals were a shamanic Neolithic culture who made jewelry and musical instruments and who communicated by singing. This makes a lot of sense when you think about how what we're able to hear of how whales communicate is very much like what we call music. So rather than us claiming that whales might have intelligence, or that they use song and music to communicate. It could be the converse of that, that they, the Neanderthals and the whales and the birds and all the life forms, have had the ability to communicate with sound and music and singing far longer than we've even existed. And we basically become desensitized to sound. We're so used to noise and having the delicate, subtle sounds of nature blocked out that we're no longer able to hear the voice of the earth. Very subtle vibrations, and this is like not even necessarily acoustic, but subsonic vibrations. Imagine being able to hear the tinkling sound of an aurora. And I've heard the little beating of bird wings many, many, many times, which normally it's drowned out by cars and lawnmowers and dogs barking and stuff like that, and the cicadas and the sound of the dozens of little bumblebees that came and alighted on my paint tray today, especially the ultramarine blue. They're attracted to the colors. It's another interesting. Now there's a bumblebee on my lavender bottle right now. Seems to be very attracted to that. The whole color perception of insects and animals, birds, that's another interesting topic. But anyway, music. What is music? The music of the spheres, of the interstellar and cosmic vibrations of the planets and galaxies. I wonder what a comet would sound like. I think the whales and dolphins can tune into all of this. My friend Moira Thames told me that, as she understood it, Egyptian hieroglyphics weren't actually a form of writing. What they were is closer to music notation, that Egyptian hieroglyphics, each of them represents a sound. So what it is, it's actually a way to pronounce sacred language, which I think is different from us. Like, I don't think that the Egyptians would stand there and just read the hieroglyphics in silence. I think they were meant to be, when they were actually being read, they would be being sung or pronounced or however, whatever vocalization techniques that they had, which we have no idea about. We've got the ultimate grandmother of sound, vibration, what the Sanskrit people from India called Om. Om, the original seed syllable, vibration of creation, from which all other manifestations of the explicate holo movement, in the expression of David Bohm, the theoretical physicist. Om is the fundamental vibration underlying all the physical reality. So what if you're able to be in a situation that's quiet enough and peaceful enough where you can actually hear the Om coming from the center of the galaxy? Anyway, I don't know about all that, but it's such a blessing to be here at Rainbow Valley. Be able to hear the cicadas and the sound of the river, the rustling of the leaves, the cicadas. I'm reminded of, speaking of voices that we can't hear, or if we listen, we might be able to hear, or that we might block out because we didn't want to hear it. There's a fantastic science fiction movie in the 1960s called The Fly, starring David Hedison. I won't tell you too much about it, but it's worth watching because at the end, you'll hear a tiny little voice. He's caught in a spider web, about to be eaten by the spider, and he's going, "Help me! Help me! Please! Help me! Help me!" So I think if we all had a greater degree of bioacoustic sensitivity and attenuated the anthropogenic noise in our environment, and actually made a conscious effort to create low noise reserves wherever we live, and to pay attention to the voice of nature and all the non-human beings who are not only singing to us, but many of them are crying out for us to help them. And the best way we could help them is to just stop doing all the stupid stuff that's our daily routine in industrial civilization. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson, signing off from here on the brink of silence, Rainbow Valley Community, Golden Bay, New Zealand, planet Earth. Live simply so that others may simply live. Good day.
I'm gonna go to the bathroom. Yeah.